In this session and our next four sessions together, we'll be talking about some of the specific negotiating gambits or tactics that are used during the negotiating process. Now, some of these may seem a bit ruthless to you. You may say, where on earth did this guy come from? I bet he's the kind of guy that would train homing pigeons and then move. In fact, I was doing a seminar in St. Louis one time, and I was standing in the back of the room waiting to be introduced when two people in front of me didn't realize I was behind them, and I heard one say to the other, have you heard this next speaker? This guy could get the gold right out of your teeth. Of course, I had to correct them because that's not negotiating, that's stealing. Now, when you get the gold out of their teeth and they thank you for it, that's negotiating. Bear in mind that even if you never use these tactics, because you might not feel comfortable using some of them, you still need to know about them, because whether you realize it or not, they're being used against you all the time. And a typical reaction from what we'll cover during these next four sessions is, I finally figured out what they did to me. Now I understand why I didn't get that proposal accepted. Now I understand why I didn't get the raise that I wanted. I understand why I didn't buy that automobile or appliance at as good a price as I could have done. So with that in mind, let's get into the tactics. First of all, the principle of nibbling. The principle of nibbling says that you can get a little bit more even after everything has been agreed to. Car dealers understand this, don't they? Car dealers know that when they get you under the lot, there's kind of a psychological resistance that has built up to the purchase. If they can get you to the point where you're thinking, yes, I'm going to buy a car, yes, I'm going to buy it here, which they do by closing you on any make and model of car, even a stripped-down model that carries very little profit for them, then they can get you into the closing room and they can add on all the other little extras that really build the profit into the car. What's happening here is that people do things to reinforce decisions that they have just made. A couple of psychologists did a study to find out exactly what was going on here, and they did it, of all places, up at a racetrack in Canada. They studied the attitudes of people immediately before they placed the bet and immediately after they placed the bet. What they found out was that before they placed the bet, the people were very uptight, unsure, and anxious about what they were about to do. Now, I want you to relate this to an employer who's not sure whether you're the right person for the promotion, another company that you've made a proposal to that is not sure that you're the right supplier for them, an offer to buy when the people are not sure whether this is the best offer they'll get or not. The other side is very uptight, unsure about what the decision that they're about to make. At the racetrack, they found out that once the people had made the decision to go ahead and had placed the bet, all of a sudden they felt very, very good about what they had just done and even had a tendency to want to double the bet before the race started. They felt that confident about what they'd just done. This is the phenomenon of people wanting to do things to reinforce decisions that they have just made. So one rule for negotiators may be that you don't necessarily ask for everything up front. You wait for that moment of agreement in the negotiations, and then you go back and you nibble for a little bit extra. You might think of the negotiating process as pushing a ball uphill, a large rubber ball that's much bigger than you, and you're forcing it up to the top of the hill. The top of the hill is the moment of the first agreement that is reached in the negotiations. Once that point is reached, then the ball moves easily down the other side of the hill. So timing is very, very critical. You see, after the initial agreement has been made, the people feel very, very good. They feel a sense of relief that the decision has been made. In their mind, the negotiation is over, and they're very, very vulnerable to a little bit more. I bet you've been the victim of a nibble at one time or another. You've been selling a car or a boat. You're finally feeling good because you found the buyer. The pressure and the tension of the negotiations has drained away. They're sitting there at the kitchen table writing out the check, and just as they're about to sign their name, they look up and they say, that does include a full tank of gas, doesn't it? You're at your most vulnerable point then in the negotiations. The counter tactic to the nibble, incidentally, is to gently make the other person feel cheap. You've got to be very careful about the way you do this, because obviously you're at a sensitive point in the negotiations. So you smile sweetly in the instance of the person asking for the tank of gas, and you say, oh, come on, you negotiated a fantastic price on the car. Don't make me give you a full tank of gas, too. Fair enough? And that's the counter tactic to the nibble when it's used against you. So consider this when you go into negotiations. Are there some elements that are better off broached as a nibble after the initial agreement position has been met? For example, let's say that you're up for a promotion with your company. They're going to promote you to vice president in charge of marketing. And you go in and you negotiate the salary and the benefits that you're going to get. One of the things that you want to get from them in the negotiations is a membership in the country club so that you can do some entertaining. I'm going to suggest to you that rather than trying to negotiate that into the negotiations themselves, you would be better off to leave that as a nibble. After everything has been agreed to, you've shaken hands, you're about to leave the president of the company's office, you turn around and you say, by the way, you do understand that I will need a membership in the country club, don't you? You're much more likely to get it than you were if you were to introduce it as an initial demand. Were you to introduce it as part of your initial demands, chances are they would use it as a trade-off situation. They would say, well, we might consider a membership in the country club, but we couldn't do that and give you the new car that you're asking for, so which would you rather have? Add it on as a nibble, you stand the best chance of getting it. Children are brilliant at nibbling, aren't they? If you have teenage children at home, you know that they don't have to take any courses on negotiating. You have to take a course in negotiating just to stand a chance of surviving, because they're naturally brilliant negotiators. My daughter Julia, when she graduated from high school, wanted to get a really nice high school graduation gift from me. She had three things on her hidden agenda. Number one, she wanted a five-week trip to Europe. Number two, she wanted $1,200 in spending money. Number three, she wanted a new set of luggage. She was smart enough not to ask for everything up front. She was smart enough to close me on the trip first and then come back a few weeks later and show me in writing, and we'll stress the importance of the in writing part later, show me in writing that the recommended spending money was $1,200 and got me to commit to that. And then right at the last minute, she came to me and she said, Dad, you wouldn't want me going to Europe with that radio set of luggage, would you? All the kids will be there with new luggage. And she got that too. And she'd asked for everything up front, I would have negotiated out the luggage, negotiated down the spending money. So always take into account the possibility of being able to nibble. Timing is very critical. Catching the other person when they feel good because they feel that the negotiations are over. On the other hand, look out for it when you're feeling good, you're very vulnerable, you're liable to make a concession, and half an hour later you'll be thinking, why on earth did I do that? I didn't have to do that. We had agreed on everything already. The principle of the hot potato is when somebody wants to give you their problem, like tossing you a hot potato at a barbecue. You want to get rid of it as quickly as you can. Now, here's the response to the hot potato. Test it for validity right away. This is exactly what international negotiators do when the other side tries to give you their problem. You have to test it for validity right away. Later on, it's too late. If you work with this problem that they've tossed you, in a short period of time, they have now established in their minds that it's your problem, and it's too late to test it. You see, what I found out from my study of international negotiations and my knowledge of business situations is that exactly the same things apply. The same rules that apply for the negotiators in Geneva when the peace conferences are on apply to interpersonal relationships, when you're trying to get a proposal accepted, when you're supervising employees and conflict comes up, or when you're trying to buy a piece of real estate or an automobile. Exactly the same things apply. Now, some instances are very familiar with the hot potato. This is the real estate salesperson who has the buyer come into the office and say, we only have $5,000 to put down. And let's assume that that's a very low down payment. The real estate person could possibly work with it, but it's going to be tough. What they should do right away is test it for validity. Well, that's fine. We can maybe work with that, you say. Later on, I'm going to teach you why you should always agree with people, whatever they say to you. That's fine. We can work with that. But let me ask you this. If I find exactly the right property for you, in exactly the right neighborhood, the price and terms are fantastic, your family's going to love it, your kids are going to love having their friends over to play, but it takes $10,000 to get in, is there any point in showing it to you, or should I just show it to my other buyers? Now, once in a great while, the person will say, look, watch my lips, don't you understand me? $5,000 is it, not a penny more. But 9 times out of 10, in my experience, they'll say, we maybe could use the CD that we have. We really didn't want to touch our certificate of deposit, but if it's a really good buy, we might. Or maybe Uncle Joe would help us with the down payment. And immediately you know that that problem that they tossed you is not the deal buster that it appeared to be. A computer salesperson might have someone come into the showroom and say, look, we can only afford to pay $3,000. And if you're willing to accept other people's problems, you'll probably confine yourself to that range, assuming that what they told you was absolutely gospel. If you learn to test it for validity up front, if I could show you a computer system that would give you double the effect of a $3,000 system and it only costs $1,000 more, would you be interested in taking a look at it? 9 times out of 10, they'll say, sure, we'll take a look at it. And you know that that price issue is not the deal buster that it appeared to be. So, look out for people giving you their problems. The counter tactic to the hot potato is to test it for validity right away. And get in the habit of not letting people give you their problems. You've got enough of your own, don't you? It's like the person who was pacing the floor at night. He couldn't sleep, and his wife was concerned about it. Darling, what's bothering you? Why don't you come to bed? And he says, well, we have this note due at the bank tomorrow, and the banker's a good friend of ours, and I just hate to face him and say that we're not going to have the money to pay for it. So the wife picked up the phone and called their friend, the banker, and said, that note that we have coming due tomorrow, we don't have the money to pay it. And the husband exploded. He said, what did you do that for? That's what I'm concerned about. And she said, well, dear, now it's his problem, and you can come to bed. Don't let other people give you their problems. Here's the principle of higher authority. You would think that if you were going out to negotiate something, you would want to have the authority to make a decision. In actual fact, you put yourself in a weakened negotiating position when you do that. Always have a higher authority that you have to check with before you can change your proposal or make a decision. Maybe you'll lose some ego from this, but you'll find it very, very effective. When I was president of the real estate company in California, I used to have salespeople coming in to sell me things all the time. Advertising, photocopy machines, computer equipment, and so on. I would always negotiate this very best price that I possibly could using all of these tactics. Then I would say to them, this looks fine. I do just have to run it by my board of directors, but I'll get back to you tomorrow with the final okay. The next day, I could get back to them and say, boy, are they tough to deal with right now. I felt sure I could sell it to them, but they just won't go along with it unless you can shave another couple of $100 off the price. I'm sure you have mixed emotions about doing that kind of thing, but I'm telling you what you run into out there for your own protection. Higher authority works a lot better when the higher authority is a vague entity, like a committee or a board of directors. For example, have you ever actually met a loan committee at a bank? I never have. I'm convinced that whatever the bank, whatever the price of the loan, there's somebody at that bank that can give you a decision without having to go to any committees. And yet they know if they said to you, your package is on the president's desk, you would say, well, let's go talk to him right now. Let's get it resolved. But you can't do that with the vague entity. The use of higher authority is a way of putting pressure on people without confrontation. For example, I own quite a lot of real estate investment property. And I have tenants to deal with. And when I first had this real estate property, I thought it was kind of neat to tell the tenants that I owned the property. It was kind of an ego trip for me. And then when my portfolio got substantial, I realized that it wasn't that much fun anymore because the tenants assumed that the owner of the property was made of money. And why would it be a problem to replace the carpeting in this unit because there's a small cigarette burn, or replace the drapes? Why would it be a problem if the rent's going to be late that month? He's rich. He's got all that property. Why is he so upset about it? Well, the minute I formed a company, Plaza Properties, my real estate investment company, and I now became the president of that company, which is a property management company managing the property for this vague group of investors out there, a lot of my problems went away. Then when they said, well, look, you know, we've got this hole in the carpet, it needs to be replaced, I'd say, well, quite frankly, I don't think I can get the owners to do that for you just yet. I tell you what, you keep the rent coming in on the first of the month, and in about 6 months, I'll go to bat for you with the owners. Let me see what I can do for you with them at that time. That's good guy, bad guy. We'll talk about that later. If they would say, Roger, we're not going to have the rent until the 15th of the month, I would say, boy, I know exactly how you feel. Sometimes it can get difficult. But unfortunately, on this property, I just don't have any leeway. The owners of this property have told me that if the rent's not in by the 5th of the month, I just have to file an eviction notice. So what can we do to get the rent in on time? It's a way of putting pressure on people without confrontation. So always maintain your own resort to higher authority. The counter tactic to higher authority is very critical. You need to learn to remove the other person's resort to higher authority before the negotiations start. This is exactly the same thing that the car dealer will do to you when he says, before he lets you take it for a test drive, "Let me be sure I understand," he'll say, "if you like this car as much as I know you're going to like it, is there any reason why you wouldn't make a decision?" This is the real estate person who will say, before they put you in the car to show you property, "Let me be sure I understand, if we find exactly the right property for you today, is there any reason why you wouldn't make a decision?" Because they know that if they don't remove the resort to higher authority up front, then there's a danger that under the pressure of asking for a decision to conclude the negotiations, the other person will invent one as a delay in tactic. "Well, gee, I'd love to give you a decision today, but I just can't because my father-in-law has to look at the car or the property, or Uncle Joe's helping us with the down payment, and we need to talk to him first." You see, one of the most difficult things you can run into when you're making a proposal, whether you're an investor or a salesperson or a negotiator for a corporation, is to make a proposal to the other person, and they say to you, "Well, that's fine. Thanks for bringing us the proposal. We will talk to our committee or our attorney or our CPA about it, and if we're interested, we'll get back to you." Where do you go from there? If you're smart enough to counter higher authority before you start, you can remove yourself from that dangerous situation. So, before you present the proposal to the other person, you would say, "Let me be sure I understand. If this proposal meets all of your needs..." Now, this is a fairly broad statement, isn't it? The other side's thinking, "Well, I can wriggle out of that one." "If this proposal meets all of your needs, is there any reason why you wouldn't give me a decision today?" Fairly harmless thing for the other person to say, "Okay, Joe, but look at what you've accomplished. Number one, you've eliminated their right to say, 'I want to think it over.'" If they say that, you say, "Well, let me go over it one more time. There must be something I didn't cover clearly enough, because you did indicate to me that you were willing to make a decision today. And secondly, you've eliminated their right to refer it to a higher authority. You've eliminated their right to say, 'I want my attorney to see it, my CPA, or the committee to take a look at it.'" So what's the counter tactic to that counter? I'm sure that there are many situations where you'll say that to people, and they'll come right out and say to you, "I'm sorry, I would like to hear the proposal, and that's what you need to do if you want to do business with that company, but I won't be making a decision today. I will have to refer it to the committee." Here's the three steps that you take as a counter to the counter. Number one, appeal to their ego. "But they always follow your recommendations, don't they?" you say, with a smile on your face. Well, with some personality styles, that's enough of an appeal to their ego. That they'll say, "Well, I guess you're right. If I like it, you can count on it. Don't worry about it. You'll get your positive answer." But more often than not, they'll say, "Well, yes, they usually follow my recommendations, but I just can't give you a decision until I've referred it to the committee." The second stage is to get their commitment that they will go to the committee with a positive proposal, and you will recommend it to them, won't you? Now, hopefully, you'll get a response like, "Well, yes, it looks like a good proposal to me, but I just want to be sure that they're going to go along with it." And this is very important. Get the commitment that they're going to go along with it. I know when I first came to this country in 1962, I went to work for a bank in California for a short period of time, and then after 9 months found that I couldn't stand the excitement of working in the banking industry and looked around for something else. I went to work for a department store chain. But before I could go to work for them, I had to be approved by the store manager of the store in which I would be assigned for training. They sent me up to Napa, California to interview with the store manager there. For whatever reason, the interview didn't go well. I knew that I wasn't going to get the job. And he said to me, "Well, Roger, thank you for coming in for the interview. I'll report back to the committee at head office and you'll be hearing from them." And I said to him, "But you will recommend me to them, won't you?" That's stage number two, asking for a commitment that they'll go in with a positive approach. I saw his mind swinging from one side to the other. He didn't want to recommend me to the committee. On the other hand, he didn't want the confrontation of telling me that he wasn't going to recommend me to the committee. And his mind went from one side to the other for a few minutes, and finally he said, "Well, yes, I guess I'm willing to give you a try." Immediately revealing that there was no higher authority, there was no committee, he was the one making the decision. So get the person's commitment that they will go in with a positive decision. First of all, there's a world of difference between them going to the committee and saying, "Look, this is what I think we should do," than saying, "Well, here's a proposal that we've had. What do you think of it?" And number three, it sets you up for the third stage of the counter-tactic, which is to go to the qualified subject to close. Now, the subject to close is the same one that your life insurance agent uses on you when he says, "Well, quite frankly, I don't know if we can get this much insurance on someone of your age. It would be subject to you passing the physical anyway, so why don't we just write up the paperwork subject to you passing the physical?" Now, he knows that if you can fog a mirror, he can get you that insurance, but it doesn't sound as though you're making as big a decision as you really are. The qualified subject to close in this particular instance would be, "Well, look, let's just write up the paperwork subject to the right of your committee to decline the proposal within a 24-hour period." Now, that's not subject to their acceptance, subject to their right to decline it for a specific reason. Now, if they're going to refer it to an attorney, it would be a legal reason. If they're going to refer it to their CPA, it would be a tax reason, and so on. But try and get it nailed down to a specific reason. What's the counter to the counter tactic? Well, if someone tried to nail me down like that, and said, "Now, you do have the authority to make a decision, don't you?" in so many words, I would say, "Well, quite frankly, it depends on the price that you propose. At some price points, I have to go to my board of directors. Some things I can approve." Having had them propose a price to me, I might say, after they proposed maybe $6,500, I would say, "Well, what a shame. I could take it to our board of directors and see what they say. It's a shame. I was hoping that you were going to come in at under $5,000 because I am authorized to go ahead up to $5,000, trying to cut that price down. But the use of higher authority is very critical to you when you're negotiating. Always maintain your own. Always try to remove the other person's resort to higher authority. The next gambit we'll talk about is how to handle an impasse. Now, it's very easy for inexperienced negotiators to confuse an impasse with a deadlock. And it's a very easy technique that you can use whenever an impasse is reached, and it's called the set-aside technique, used very, very effectively by the American negotiators right after the 1972 Arab-Israeli War. We went to the Israelis and we said, "Look, please at least sit down and talk to the Egyptians, because if you don't, somebody's going to start World War III around here." And they threw us what might easily have been perceived as a deadlock, the killer in the negotiations. They said, "Well, we might be willing to talk to them, but we want you to understand up front there's one thing that is absolutely non-negotiable. We will never, ever withdraw from the Sinai. We took it during the 1972 war. That's where our oil wells are. We will never, ever withdraw." Have you had clients present something like that, that forcefully with you? "We want you to know that we might talk to you about you doing business with us, but we would absolutely never, ever go along with such and such." If that's what you want to talk about, forget it. Well, we were smart enough to use the set-aside technique. It's very, very effective. You'll be amazed how this will resolve what appear to be major issues when you're negotiating with people. We said, "That's fine. We understand exactly how you feel about the Sinai." Now, we also understood, although we didn't reveal it to them, that the Egyptians were just as adamant about getting the Sinai back as the Israelis were not relinquishing it. We said, "We understand exactly how you feel about the Sinai. That's where your oil fields are. You took it during the 72 war and so on. But look, let's just set that issue aside and get together and talk about some of the other issues that are important to us." It's exactly the same technique that you would use if you were talking as a supplier to a factory and then they said to you, "Look, we might be interested in talking to you, but we would want you to know that you have to be able to get your price down below 97 cents a unit. Now, even if your absolute lowest price is $1.25 a unit, use the set-aside technique. I understand exactly how important price is to you. Let's just set that aside for a minute and talk about the other issues. Now, how important is delivery date to you? How would you want the packaging done? And you resolve a lot of the little issues first in an attempt to establish some momentum leading up to the big issues. Now, as we told you when we talked about win-win negotiating, don't narrow it down to just one issue. But resolving the little issues first establishes momentum. See, inexperienced negotiators seem to think that you need to resolve the big issues first. Boy, if we can't get together on the biggies like price and terms, why waste a lot of time talking to them about the little issues? What you find out is that those apparently unresolvable impasses become a lot more flexible after you've found some agreement on the small issues. So establish that momentum. And as you know, in the Arab-Israeli crisis, we eventually did see the Israelis withdrawing from the Sinai in spite of the fact that they assured us initially that that's the last thing in the world they would ever do. If you do actually reach a deadlock in the negotiations, the only way to resolve a deadlock is to bring in a third party who is perceived as reasonably neutral by the other two parties. Now, some industries, notably the automobile industry and the timeshare industry, or the promotional land industry, use the third-party clause very, very frequently. But anybody can use it in a negotiation, and it's very, very important. But the key issue here is that the third party has to be perceived as reasonably neutral by the other person. It appears we've reached a deadlock here, and I don't know how we're ever going to resolve it. But look, I know a fellow who is in our association in this industry, and he seems to be very good at finding a way past these deadlocks. Why don't we bring him in and see how he feels about it? You might also describe this as the arbitrator route. When a union goes on strike, if it's a critical union, the federal government will eventually insist that an arbitrator be appointed, a neutral third party. Attorneys use this frequently. I was once involved in a negotiation for the sale of a major company to another one. And as you can imagine, we had two huge teams of attorneys that were working, trying to resolve all the difficulties, which were many, many. After weeks and weeks of negotiating, we appeared to reach what was an absolute deadlock. And what happened was, one of the attorneys said, "Now look, it's obviously going to take more time than I thought it would. I have to be in court this afternoon. But I tell you what, Joe, my partner, will be in after lunch and take my place." Well, Joe comes in after lunch. Now, he's completely new to the negotiations. Each side has to explain where they are in the negotiations. Joe took great pains to position himself as neutral in the negotiations. In actual fact, he said to the other side, "Look, I think we're being a little unfair to you in suggesting that we do that. I think it will be fairer if we conceded this point to you." Having positioned himself as neutral and being new to the negotiations, having all of the things to be explained to him over and over again, he was able to find a common ground in the negotiations that got us past the deadlock. So anytime you actually do reach a deadlock in the negotiations, then the thing to do is to bring in a third party who's perceived as reasonably neutral by the other parties. In session four, we'll get into some more fascinating negotiating gambits, including good guy, bad guy, and why you should never jump at the first offer.
This is the end of side three. Side four is already queued up for your listening.